right, well, let's go ahead and call our Children, Youth, and Families Committee meeting to order so we can start. Go ahead and recording. Thank you. Welcome, everybody, to our meeting of the Children, Youth, and Families Committee. Today, we are going to be focusing on child welfare issues in particular. And we're going to start out with a work session talking about an issue that has been covered extensively in the news, which are hotel and office stays for some of our youth involved with child welfare. We'll then be having a public hearing on two pieces of legislation, House Bill 1061 and House Bill 1186. Just for the public, I just want to mention a couple things. One, thank you for staying with us and giving us a little bit of grace as we deal with technology issues. We are all adapting to that. So sometimes we might drop off or stay on mute or something like that, and appreciate your understanding of that, and recognize that that might happen to those testifying as well. So if that happens to you, no worries, you can come back on and we will accommodate. However, another note about the technology is that if you sign up to pro or con, but not wishing to testify, unfortunately, after an hour before the meeting, you won't be able to switch that around. So if you are considering testifying, even though you are, or you'd rather just register that you are pro and con, but don't wish to testify, give it an extra thought. Again, given we won't be able to move you on the fly like we have done in the past in person. And then in terms of the agenda for the week, I do just want to let folks know that we had a possible agenda item on Thursday of execing two pieces of legislation. We'll be moving those till next week. So just wanted to let the committee or the audience know that as well. So with that, I would like to call forward our first presenter, again, talking about hotel stays for youth involved with child welfare, and would like to call forward Patrick Dowd, the director of the Washington State Office of the Family and Children's Ombuds.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Dowd. I'm director of the Office in the Family and Children's Ombuds. And thank you for the opportunity to present this afternoon on placement exceptions, the term that is used to describe situations where children spend the night in a hotel or a DCY, Department of Children, Youth, and Families, DCYF, office building overnight because of a lack of a licensed placement resource. So here are some key points that we identified in our 2020 annual report. Over the past year, there were 1,863 placement exceptions in 2020. And this was a significant increase of 349 stays from the previous year in 2019. There were 220 children, individual children, that experienced a hotel or office placement. And to put this in some perspective, first of all, this was a decline from 282 children in 2019. And this represents a small group of the perhaps 8,000 children that are in state care at any one time. We're talking about 220 children that experienced a hotel or office placement. I don't say that to minimize the impact of this problem or issue in the least, but I do think it's important to put it in perspective, because then I think in identifying a solution, I think it's much more manageable. The children who experience placement exceptions are often involved in multiple systems, whether it's the juvenile justice system or receiving services from developmental disabilities, and also have complex care needs. And I'll talk more about that in a slide coming up. But that just shows kind of where it describes why the department struggles with placing many of these children. Another key takeaway: that of the 220 children that experienced the placement exception, 43 children made up 75% of those placement exceptions, or almost 1,400 nights in either a hotel or DCYF office. And again, we're talking about even a smaller subgroup of that 220, that I think if we can solve that problem and identify services and placements to meet that needs, that would go a long way to solving this issue. Additionally, with COVID-19, that's had an impact on placement exceptions. There are fewer foster homes that are able or willing to accept children because of COVID-19, and also circumstances where a child will run from a foster home, and then the foster parent will be reluctant to have that children back in immediately for fear that the child may have been exposed to COVID-19 while absent from placement. And then the other takeaway is, keep in mind, these numbers do not include night-to-night foster home placements, which is where a child is placed in a foster home overnight and then goes to the department office, spends the day in the office, and then goes back to a foster home from, say 6 o'clock in the evening till 7 o'clock in the morning, and then is back in the office again. And those night-to-night placements can be equally disruptive, I think, for children in state care. This slide shows the increase of placement exceptions over the years. And in 2015, when the Ombuds Office first started tracking this and was aware of the problem, I was alarmed that it was 120, and it's consistently increased. The next slide shows a monthly count over the past year. And I think the takeaway here is the impact of COVID-19, that after March, the numbers were considered, the lowest month was April with 151. And then it varied up as high as 227 placement exceptions. Location of placements as exceptions, most of these occur in hotels. 284 were in department office buildings, and the majority of those were in Region 6. And one thing we found is that Region 6 actually took what I think is somewhat of an innovative approach to dealing with placement for youth who might have been exposed to COVID-19, and making a decision rather than house multiple children in a hotel room, they would place children individually in visitation rooms, protect the child and other children, in placement exceptions, and it was just a different kind of strategic decision to utilize office space rather than hotels.
And this what is Region 6?
Region 6 is Southwest Washington, so Clark County, Vancouver, up north through the Olympic Peninsula to Clallam County. This slide shows, again, that when you look at the last two columns, the 19 and 24 children, so 43 children spent 10 or more nights in a hotel, and that made up about 75% of the placement exceptions. So again, that's the core kind of children and youth that are driving this issue, in my view, are those 40 to 50 children. When we drill down and look at the children that experienced 20 or more nights in placement exceptions, we found that many of them had multiple characteristics and behaviors that, again, made it more challenging for the department to meet their placement needs, including sexualized behavior, a history of running from placement, suicidal ideation or behavior, physically aggressive or violent behavior, and mental health issues. Where do we track where the children ended up? Of the 20 children that spent, or the children that spent 20 nights or more, five of them remain in placement exceptions, or at the time of our report did. And 11 of the remaining 15 ended up in BRS placement or group care. So again, I think it underscores the level of placement resources that are needed. Racial disproportionality is also evident in placement exceptions, with Black African American children overrepresented. previous reports, we recommended that the department develop a continuum of placement resources to meet this needs. We continue to make that recommendation. However, this year we also acknowledge that if we're not able to solve this problem immediately, then the department should take steps to make hotel stays or office stays more normal for and more stable for the children that are being served. And in the interest of time, I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks for being aware of time. Much appreciated. So we're pretty tight. So I'm going to entertain one question. Representative Clippert had his hand up, and then we're going to move to Secretary Hunter. And then maybe at the end, if we have time, we will take more questions. Representative Clippert.
Thank you, ma'am. Patrick, foster care is a passion of mine. I've been a foster parent and would love to work with you to help increase the number of foster parents across the state. And just my question to you is, do you have a percentage of what you think the number of foster parent decrease has been due to COVID? It's not shocking to have me for you to say that, but it's kind of surprising to me because they're usually people just love kids and that wouldn't get in the way.
So thank you, Representative Clippert. We spoke with representatives, I think, in Region 4, which is King County, and received information that up to a 30% reduction in available licensed foster homes. So this would be licensed foster homes that are saying, well, we have, you know, grandparents also living in the home. We just can't take on more children, or we're not accepting placement at this time. One of the go ahead.
If I can help with this in any way, please let me know, because I'd love to help you recruit more foster care parents.
Thank you, Representative Clippert.
Thanks. Thank you. All right, I'm going to now welcome up Secretary Ross Hunter, who's the head of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. It's so nice to have you with us. We haven't seen you yet this session, and we're excited to have you join us.
Well, I'm happy to be here. And because unlike you, this is actually a holiday for us. So I chose not to wear a tie. That's my only concession to that, though.
Well, extra thanks to everybody who's joining us on this holiday.
Yeah. And remembering that it was not a holiday for the legislature when I had the great joy of doing that. So I am going to pop up my video screen here and see if I can succeed in sharing.
If you need any help with technology, Ross, Secretary, you know, we know that that can be challenging for some people.
I'd be happy to check in.
Former tech.
Should I actually need that assistance? Thank you. So I am the Secretary of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Actually, my department has a second comma in it. We'll have to work with our staff about that. Allison. Youth, comma, and families. And here we go. So I want to thank Patrick, and I think I said in my letter responding to his report that he had excoriated us over this. And I agree that was the words I used. And I think it's incredibly appropriate that he excoriates the agency over this problem. It is not a problem, however, that is unique to Washington. We've put a lot of time into trying to solve this problem and had a rough strategy last year, which you guys helped us with some additional placement resources, which are slowly coming online. I pushed in September, I created a group to do a cross-agency group to come and give me an actual detailed strategy and a report on how we should deal with this. And I wanted them to hear from external partners on that as well. They have done that. They have briefed me on it. The report got finalized last week. And it's an internal report. I mean, it's not all formatted and stuff for external, but if you guys want it, we're happy to send it over. We may have already done that. Patrick's work has been pretty good. We've done a bunch of statistical work on this and tried to separate the young people who have experienced this into three groups. The low users, they get one night, you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, we remove a kid, it's just easier to like bring the kid to the office or to a hotel. Then it's easier for everyone concerned than to call 15 people at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we're also more likely to get a placement at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I think the one night, if that was the only problem we would have, it would be a problem, but it would not be a horrendous problem. The high users, which make up 34% in this particular example, is 258 children, have the vast bulk of these stays. And that is absolutely the problem that needs to occur. Patrick pointed at risk factors. We've done some more regression analysis on this to look at really how heavily weighted are these factors. And this is not a problem with a silver bullet solution. If you give me more of this resource, it will not completely solve this problem. Broadly, three sort of big groups pop out at you. Children with criminal records who come from the juvenile incarceration system in one way or another, either directly from the counties, often with no notice to us. We had a problem with JR releasing kids to child welfare without notice. That we have resolved that, and we have done a lot more planning around that. But young people who have committed a crime that makes it difficult or unsafe for their family to take the child back. There may be no allegations of child abuse or neglect, and in fact, that's relatively common in the population that we're serving. The other two broad categories, and these categories overlap, is children with a mental health diagnosis and children with a developmental disability, who often come to us in a transition from one of the other service systems. And we get a kid and this kid needs a clip bed. And we don't really have any facilities that provide that level of care. And it's not safe for us to have the kids in hotels either, frankly. But so doing some analysis on this, so justice involvement, I hesitate to use the word justice, but involvement with the law enforcement system, mental health involvement and disability involvement are the three broad categories that we would look at. We looked at where were they coming to us from BRS. So internal from our system, they were in a group home, from a CRC, which is a youth, that or a hope bed are children experiencing homelessness. From detention, you can see the increased prevalence of high users, high hotel users in those categories. But you can also see that these categories are there isn't somebody at 50% of the problem. The hospital situation can often be a child with developmental disabilities who blew out of a placement, was placed in a hospital, they had maybe had a breakdown, and the hospital needed to release them, and there wasn't a DD facility for them. Could also be a child being released from a mental hospital. Almost 20% of the kids come in having been on the run before. We have increased the number of placements. You approved BRS Plus beds. We expect to roll those out by March 1st. We're a little slow on that, and I apologize for that. The COVID disaster ate up a lot of our people, and then our fiscal staff were all furloughed for much of July. Nevertheless, this is pretty high priority. I would have wished we had gotten that done earlier. We probably lost a month or two in that. We improved the number of beds by 27 just with improved licensing behavior and been really working on recruiting additional BRS beds. The placement resources redesign, why do we use these words? What this means is we're working with SAMHSA, which is one of the sub parts of HHS in DC. We have a grant and we're rolling out some therapeutic foster care beds. They just started rolling out in December. We expect to roll them out over the next year or so. We'll get up to 15 beds there. Single child, single family, wraparound psychological support. We're pretty excited about this option, which we think is healthier for children than a lot of group homes. And then we also have some kids that are out of state. This is a separate but related problem. I was unwilling to have 84 children out of state and have reduced that down to 14. It was 12 the last time I looked. We're trying to continue to drive that down to zero. But if we don't have a placement for a child in state, and we will go to an out-of-state provider rather than having the child stay in hotels night after night after night, which is not good for people. It's not good for our staff, and it's not good for the youth.
And Ross,
Secretary
Hunter, we just have a couple more minutes.
Yep. So the recommendations in our internal report were some things we can do. That's the practice side. Some of those will need some financial support, adding additional staff, one in each of the six regions to coordinate the mental health work is something that you could help us with in budget. Expanding the definition of relative to include suitable others would allow us to have a lot more variety of placement options. Placing a child with family is much more likely to reduce this hotel stay problem than trying to place an often fractious team with a stranger. And there's some shared planning meetings that we are changing our internal practice around to really improve the quality and consistency of. We need more DDA beds. And here's a place where I have a deep concern, which is we have young people who have severe needs who cannot be served in their current placement. They get bumped into a hospital. There's no placement for them. The hospital releases them onto the street and the law enforcement calls us to pick the child up and it doesn't work. This is not a huge fraction of the population, but these young people are going to be served. If they're served by us, they're served at 100% state general fund. If they're served by DEA, it's there's Medicaid match. Just if it's just about cost, it'll be better to leave them in the DD system. We would like you to make a legal requirement to have DDA participate in case planning. Other agencies are required to participate. It would be helpful and would produce more consistent planning for having plans for these youth. We also need more clip beds. 15 of them you approved last year are slowly coming online. That's in the HCA does that. And that's our presentation. This is an egregious problem and we're working on it.
Thank you for coming with data and with suggestions on solutions. Much appreciated. I now want to invite Selena Deer, who is at the front lines as a social services specialist from the department, who is working with a lot of these kids, to share what it's like and her experiences. Selena, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Selena Deer, and I'm a social worker out of Region 6. I've been a social worker with the department since January of 2017, and I work in the Vancouver office. I've done a variety of roles within the department, including after-hours work. Every night, social workers in Region 6 are supervising our young people in hotel rooms and DCYF offices. And the young people that I'm referring to are our most vulnerable foster children in out-of-home care. The impact that hotel and office stays have on our young people is detrimental. It creates instability, lack of consistency and expectations, trust issues, and it intensifies their mental and behavioral health. These children end up feeling hopeless, inadequate, and unwanted. These children need specialized services to address their behaviors, to allow them to function in a placement that will create stability and a semblance of normalcy. had some connection issues. I'm not sure. I'm back. I'm going to go back to where I think I left off. So I was talking about the impact that the hotel stays and office stays have on our young people. I was saying that it creates instability, a lack of consistency, trust issues, and intensifies their behavioral and health, mental health needs. These children oftentimes end up feeling hopeless, inadequate, and unwanted. And these are kids that need specialized services to address their behaviors to allow them to function in a placement that will create stability and some semblance of normalcy. So in 2019, I spent over 350 hours in hotel and office stays outside of my normal work week. And I want to share with you the story of one young person whose name has been changed to protect his privacy. Charlie was discharged from a juvenile detention facility without a plan that would have created stability for him. He was then placed in the department's custody due to his family's lack of ability to care for him. Charlie's history consisted of causing serious injury to adults, arson, and he also experienced episodes of psychosis that presented with visions of demons and monsters. Charlie spent 5 months in hotels, offices, hospitals, and night-to-night foster care homes that required constant... Oh, my gosh.
You're good. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. So I still have... okay. I still have voice. Sorry. So he spent a number of nights jumping around from...
Oops, now you muted yourself. There you go.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
So during the time that we were supervising Charlie, he required constant line of sight supervision. During that time, I witnessed firsthand episodes of psychosis, suicidal ideations, run episodes from department staff, self-harming behavior, sexualized behaviors, physical assaults on other foster youth, and threats to the department staff that were supervising him. As a social worker, I was not equipped to provide him the level of care that he needed or provide the services that he needed. I became a social worker to help people, and in this situation, I felt completely helpless. I was overcome with feelings of defeat, frustration, inadequacy due to the limited services that were available to rehabilitate this youth. The services that were available had long wait lists, and the fact that there were no homes or programs willing to take Charlie, it turned into this repetitive cycle of trying to manage his immediate day-to-day needs while sitting in a DCY office, going to hotels, at night, and then the constant search of trying to find a qualified residential treatment program that could meet his needs. After months of night-to-night placements, he was accepted to a quality residential treatment program, and he received 9 months of intensive rehabilitation services to prepare him for a transition to a foster home in an environment that was stable, consistent, and provided some sense of family and normal life. Hotels and offices were not made to house our foster youth. In Charlie's case, the available treatment, the lack of available treatment and stable placement added unnecessary trauma and deteriorated his mental state. And I feel like we really failed this child. The message we're sending to our young people is that we do not care enough to provide the services that they need. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today regarding my experience working with our most vulnerable youth in the foster care system.
Thank you, Selena, for sharing your personal experiences and for clearly caring so much about their kids and for staying in the field despite the challenges. And it really drew a picture, I think, for us of what what services are needed, what the department is facing, and then more importantly, the human toll on both you and Charlie. So thank you so much for sharing. I'd also like to welcome Emmy Blackledge, who is the executive director of the Mockingbird Society, which works with foster youth. Annie, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Sen and committee members.
For the Annie, record, can't I'm Annie hear Black- you very well.
Oh,
if you can be a little louder.
Okay, let's see. How's that?
Much better. Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Sen and committee members. For the record, I'm Annie Blackledge, and I am with the Mockingbird Society. And I just want to take a moment to thank Selena. If we had been in person and no COVID, I would have probably wanted to give you a hug. What a great social worker you are. So I'm sure, as all of you are, I'm struck by the cost and intensive staff time it takes to place a child in a hotel, a motel, or an office. But what really hits closer to home for me, and I think Selena really did a great job of emphasizing this, is the cost to the child. To hear that you're a problem to be solved, that there's no place for you, to know that love, acceptance, and home are conditional concepts, and to be unwanted. The cost to our children and young people is immeasurable. And I know none of us wants it to be this way, but it's how it will continue to be unless we begin to think of reform differently. And I will say one of the great privileges of my work life right now is that half of my colleagues are under the age of 25, and they refuse to accept the world as is. And they all believe in a better world that could be. And that world is the world that they and Jim Theophilus were aiming for when they developed the Mockingbird family approach to foster care. This approach ensures that families and children have the support they need, and it's founded on the idea that everyone needs a community, and it pairs 6 to 10 foster kinship families and kinship families with nearby experienced foster or kinship family that can provide respite, crisis support, targeted trainings, and more. The result is greater retention of foster parents and greater placement stability for children. We know that Mockingbird family is only one of many solutions that need to be implemented. The issue of hotel stays, along with many others, cannot be addressed in isolation, as really they're just indicative of larger systemic fault lines. They're also deeply embedded in race and class. Like many of our other systems, our child welfare system is one that has been built on the back of families and children of color and the poor. This session, you'll hear about other critical components to building a just and equitable child welfare response, such as focusing on family prevention and efforts to keep families together, the importance of family and sibling visitation, and developmentally appropriate transitions from foster care. You know, I think it's really tempting to think of these issues of hotel and motel stays as a math problem to solve, you know. We had X number of places for Y number of youth, then we get to a solution. And yes, placement is an important part of the response, but it's the other issues that I've highlighted, keeping families safely together when possible, ensuring children have authentic connection to their siblings and other families when they must be placed into care, and meeting their unique developmental needs is also crucial. I would be remiss if I didn't point out that we also need to look to other systems too, as I think Secretary Hunter so well illustrated. Education, public health, labor, and other government institutions all have a role to play in addressing the welfare of children and youth. These current siloed approaches, while well-intentioned, leave gaps that result in undue burden on families, youth, and communities. Families must be at risk of losing their children to the system or to the streets before we pay attention. And by then, it's costly, more intensive, and we often can't undo the traumas that they and their children have experienced. Long-term, we must move from reactive to proactive systems responses. We must have more transformational approaches instead of tinkering around the edges. In the short term, we must focus on providing as much stability for young people who have been brought into the system as possible, and as much connection to family and to the people that they love and who love them.
Thank you so much for your time and attention. Thank you so much. Well, I am so appreciative of setting up the stage for actually our public hearing on two pieces of legislation that I think do get to the crux of some of these issues. Of course, there's much to do as well, much more to do than just these two bills. before us, but and I do recognize that some of my colleagues have wanted to ask questions, but given the number of people signed up to testify on these bills, I'm gonna ask that we hold those. And hopefully if we have time at the end, we can at least hear the questions and then we can share them with the presenters and maybe get some answers, especially easily if they're with the department, since we know where to reach them in particular. So thank you. At this point, we're gonna transition to the public hearing on two bills. And first we're gonna hear House Bill 1061 and ask Luke for a briefing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Luke Wickham, committee counsel. And as Chair Sen indicated, House Bill 1061 relates to youth eligible for developmental disability services who are expected to exit the child welfare system. By way of background, the dependency court petition process allows anyone, including the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, to file a petition alleging that the child should be a dependent of the state due to abuse, neglect, or because there is no parent, guardian, or custodian capable for caring for the child. The filing of that dependency petition starts a process where a court will hold a shelter care hearing within 72 hours of the child's removal and a fact-finding hearing where the court will determine whether the child meets the definition of dependent for these purposes.
Sorry, Luke, is this 1061?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead. Thanks.
Did you think that this was a different bill? Sorry, Madam Chair.
Yeah, the DD.
That's right. Okay. So I'm just trying to give some background around the dependency court process. No problem. This dependency court process can continue until the child turns age 18, and youth may choose to receive extended foster care services until age 21. This court process and the services provided to children in this system are often referred to as the child welfare system. The Department of Social and Health Services offers services under five Medicaid waivers, which are designed to allow eligible clients who live in community settings to receive the same level of services related to developmental disabilities that that person would receive in an institutional setting. So each of those departments provide different services for child welfare and then for developmental disabilities. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families is required to convene a shared planning meeting. I think this was referred to by Secretary Hunter's presentation. So there is a requirement in statute that the Department of Children, Youth, and Families convenes a shared planning meeting that includes the Department of Social and Health Services, Developmental Disability Administration for youth ages 17 to 17 and a half, for those youth who will be aging out of foster care. And if those youth qualify for Developmental Disability Administration services, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families is required to direct those youth to apply for services and provide assistance in the application process. House Bill 1061 requires the Department of Children, Youth, and Families to collaborate with the Developmental Disability Administration to determine the number of individuals under age 21 who are eligible for Medicaid waiver services administered by DDA, the Developmental Disability Administration, who are also dependent children and expected to exit child welfare proceedings after reaching the maximum age in the child welfare system, either age 18 or 21. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families is required to prepare an annual report that includes that number of individuals who are eligible for developmental disability services and include information in that report around best serving those youth. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families is also required to convene a shared planning meeting that includes Developmental Disability Administration staff a year earlier, so between the ages of 16 and 16 and a half, to begin planning services for the youth in advance of the youth's transition. A fiscal note has been requested on the bill, but not yet received. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Luke about the briefing of the bill? Okay, thank you very much. Well, I am pleased to bring forward this legislation with my good ranking member, Representative Dent. We did hear this bill last year. It's been slightly altered to help reduce the fiscal note. But, you know, it almost goes without saying, given the presentation that we just heard, the work session we just had, we have too many youth with disabilities in particular, too many foster youth overall, but also youth with disabilities who, when they age out of foster care, don't have a set plan as to what's going to happen with them. And we want to make sure that we know who these kids are. They're in the system. So we want to make sure that we do better planning with them and for them, and that we have a place where they're going to go so they don't end up in homelessness and they don't end up in hospitals. And so we're asking DCYF and DDA to work together to do some more advanced planning farther in advance and to share that information. Also, in the governor's budget, for instance, there are a number of SOLAs, which are places where youth can live and with developmental disabilities. And if we have this kind of information, we can make sure that those places are built or organized in the areas where those youth are currently in foster care to make sure that they can stay in their own communities. So this is really an opportunity to do advanced planning, to take care of the youth as they exit out of foster care and make sure that their transition is smooth and appropriate. So thank you very much. And with that, we will move into public testimony. I would like to let folks know watching today, this is our first public testimony round, so bear with us. What we're going to do is we're going to share who we're going to call up first, and then we'll also share who's going to be coming up next. So please listen for your name. And as we call your name, our staff will be moving you from waiting room to the committee room, and you will have 3 minutes to testify. And unlike in person, where we used to have a red light and green light and a yellow light, we will just have one of our vice chairs kind of giving you the nod or giving me the nod that your time is up. So I appreciate you bearing with us and as we figure out the mechanics of the system. So with that, Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will go ahead and start with Ramona Hattendorf, followed by Ivanova Smith and Diana Stadden. So Ms. Hattendorf, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Sen and committee members. I'm Ramona Hattendorf. I'm with the ARC of King County. We protect and promote the rights of people with developmental disabilities, and we advocate for inclusion. Belonging is essential to both personal well-being and public health. We really strongly support the intent of this bill to reduce exits into homelessness and to maximize cost-effective services. We are worried, however, that the foster youth will be exiting to a DDA waiting list of 14,000. We are also worried that assistance to get and keep DDA eligibility isn't mandated until age 17. But we have some ideas for you, and we don't think they would add to the fiscal note. This bill will absolutely help some youth, and we really do thank the sponsors. We like this bill. Want to be clear about that. Direction around future planning is deeply appreciated. But we think we can tackle some inequity. Mainly, foster youth need to be prioritized for DDA supports. And we believe the legislature has that power. On the basic plus waivers, you already prioritize transition program graduates who want employment support. They get a priority placement to transition into a basic plus waiver. So we think that you could similarly designate former foster youth as a priority group for the basic plus or the core waivers. This would not commit you to funding new waivers. It just tells the DDA to prioritize eligible foster youth when these waivers open up. And we think that would help one inequity that we see. We could also move up the age for DCYF to identify youth who qualify for DDA supports. As you just heard, currently it's age 17, and that's the year after the shared planning meeting the bill calls for. So if we had DCYF do that screening and application support at say age 15, then more youth could benefit from the proposed shared planning meeting. The need to find and support youth who were never assessed for DDA eligibility or who miss key reassessment deadlines was something that was flagged a few years ago by advocates, and it remains a strong concern of ours. We do support what this bill wants to do. We just hope you will consider these amendments. And I just want to add by saying, continuing to exit young adults with really significant cognitive and behavioral disabilities into a DDA system that does not track them, that has no mechanisms to inform the legislature of what these youth and others need, is really problematic. We do need some reform on the DDA side, but this bill will do some good. And we just want to say we really need to prioritize foster youth for support as these DDA waivers become available. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And moving on to Ivanova Smith, please, followed by Diana Stadden. Do we have Ms. Smith?
Hello, this is Ivanova Smith. I am the chair of South Advocate in Lisa. Thank you for allowing me to be here today, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I represent Self Advocates and Leadership Sale. We are in support of this bill. We feel it is important that fosters students that are transitioning get the support they need. DDA eligibility in applying is really hard, and if you don't have a family to help you with that paperwork, you know, people can be missed and not get the support they need. And those people can get themselves into different systems that are more harmful and not helpful toward the disabilities. And so I think it's very important that the foster youth get the support they need to make that transition. And if they need DDA services, that they get those services in the community and not fall off of the adult cliff that many have fallen off due to not being able to do the paperwork and needing help. And so I'm very excited for this legislation and hope it gets through. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And next we'll hear from Diana Stadden, followed by Adrienne Stewart. Do we have Ms. Stadden? Does
Let's
anyone
go ahead and move to see if Adrienne is available?
Madam Chair, it doesn't look like she's in the attendees.
One moment. It takes a moment. She's in there. One moment, please.
Thank you.
I see that Diana Stadden is now present, or do you need some technical assistance?
Well, I think I'm unmuted, but I can't start my video. Oh, okay. There it goes. Okay, never mind, I got it.
Great, right. We can see you and hear you.
Thank you, Chair Sand and members of the committee. My name's Diana Stadden with the ARC of Washington State, advocating for people with developmental disabilities. And we are very grateful to you, Chair Sand, for bringing this bill forward again. We do need to address this issue. Listening to Secretary Hunter talk about some of the numbers and that case manager, the social worker as well, all kids are going to have difficulty if they're not in some kind of a normal situation where they can depend on things to happen. But people with developmental disabilities, especially like autism, it's even more difficult to try and make a whole bunch of transitions and not be, knowing what's going to happen next. I really am grateful that you are having DCYF and DDA sit down together to plan things. And the earlier, the better, because we don't know what is going to happen within the DB system. We know it's very underfunded. That's why we have a 14,000 person wait list. And so getting those kids identified as early as possible so that services can be set up and prioritized and actually made available when they need them, you know, before they're dumped on the streets is really important. So we just want you to know we support this bill and thank you for bringing it forward again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And moving on now to Adrienne Stewart, please. If we have her on.
She might have dropped off. Why don't we go ahead and call the next speaker?
Yes. And next on to Betty Schweiderman, please. Do we have Betty Schweiderman?
I think Ulrich has to bring her in. It'll be just a sec.
Great.
All right, welcome, Betty.
All right. Hi. Good afternoon, Chair Sen and members of the committee. I'm Betty Schweiderman. I'm with the Office of Developmental Disability Ombuds, an independent agency tasked with monitoring services and making recommendations for improvements. Thank you so much for your efforts to address the gaps in services for youth with developmental disabilities who are exiting the foster care system. This is a very good start. Currently, the coordination of services is on a case-by-case basis, and there's a need for a more systemic coordination between the Department of Children, Youth, and Families and Developmental Disabilities Administration. And that coordination needs to focus on the needs of the youth by identifying and addressing barriers to transition to adult services. I'm worried that there are not the resources for staffing these efforts in both DCYF and DDA. And because staff will need to assist youth with the application process if they're not already identified as eligible, and we do know that there probably are youth that are in the system that are that would qualify for DDA services, but they may have and they may have missed the application process and gotten dropped off of the eligibility process, so they'd have to reapply. And that eligibility process can be very complicated. So there would need to be staff dedicated to do that. I also worry that so that would possibly lead to an undercount of the youth because they did not have the support to complete the eligibility process. There's also a need for staffing, not just to plan, but also for the support to implement the plan for successful transitions to adult services. Thank you again for addressing this very important issue.
Thanks so much, Betty. Is Adrienne back in? Not look like it.
One moment for Adrienne.
Wonderful. Thanks.
I'm here.
Yay! Hi.
Welcome. And you're ready.
You hear me? Okay. Now we're on House Bill 1061, right? Fair Start for Kids.
No, this is the DD foster care, making sure that children exiting foster care with DD have some advanced planning.
Okay. I didn't think I signed up for that bill, but I will echo all of the comments and concerns from my colleagues Ramona Hattendorf, Ivanova, and Betty. So I apologize for the confusion.
No worries. If you're looking for a fair start, it's on Thursday.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay.
No worries. All right. Thank you very much. I think that closes the public, those wishing to testify. And Madam Vice Chair, are there those signed in not wishing to testify?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are 11 others who have signed in pro and do not wish to comment at this time.
Can you please read their names and organizations for the record?
Yes, we have Lori Lippold with Partners for Children, Liz Troutman, the Mockingbird Society, Bailey DeLong from Vashon, Washington, Nicholas Oakley from Center of Children and Youth Justice, Lisa Thatcher with Washington State Hospital Association, Melissa Johnson, Community Residential Services Association, Neil Beaver with Neil Beaver Consulting, Daira Farivar from Disability Rights Washington, Aaron McCann with Legal Counsel for Youth and Children, David Green from the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, and Dawn Rains with Treehouse, all pro. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Rule. And with that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 1061. And move to the hearing on House Bill 1186. Luke.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Luke Wickham, committee counsel. House Bill 1186 relates to creating the community transition program for individuals serving a period of time in a juvenile rehabilitation institution. By way of background, most individuals charged with criminal offenses that occur before the individual turns age 18 appear in juvenile court, and if found guilty of that offense, receive a juvenile disposition similar to an adult sentence. Confinement that's imposed as part of that juvenile disposition of up to 30 days is spent in a county juvenile detention facility, and any confinement imposed greater than 30 days is served through commitment at a Department of Children, Youth, and Families juvenile rehabilitation facility or institution. There are three juvenile rehabilitation institutions in the state, including Echo Glen, Green Hill, and Nacelle. Individuals may move from one of those institutions to a community facility after being placed on minimum security status, and there are eight community facilities across the state. House Bill 1186 establishes a community transition program within the Department of Children, Youth, and Families that allows individuals who were being served by one of those juvenile rehabilitation institutions to receive community-based custody. Under this program, the department supervises the person with technology capable of determining the person's presence at a particular location, and the department provides access to programs to promote successful reentry, including behavioral health treatment, independent living, employment, education, and connections to family and natural resources. A person is eligible for this program if the person has served at least 60% of their minimum term of confinement and has an earned release date before their 26th birthday, and has been reviewed by the department, which has determined that such placement is in the best interest of the person and the community. Certain persons are not eligible for this program, including persons with pending charges or warrants, level 3 sex offenders, and persons requiring out-of-state placement. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families is authorized to provide rental vouchers to individuals in this program for a period not exceeding 6 months if those individuals don't have an approved residence to transition to. And the Institute for Public Policy is required to assess the community transition program to determine its impact on community safety, racial disproportionality, recidivism, state expenditures, and youth rehabilitation. A fiscal note is available indicating general fund state estimated expenditures of about $4 million in the next biennium, and then about $5.4 million in subsequent biennia for the Department of Children, Youth, and Families to hire counselors, provide goods and services, and other expenses. That concludes my remarks. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Luke. Are there any questions from committee members for Luke about the content of the bill? Okay, seeing none, I'd like to welcome our own Representative Goodman to share his thoughts on his bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and fellow members of the committee. For the record, I'm Roger Goodman from the 45th Legislative District. Been serving on this committee for more than a dozen years now, and I currently serve as the chair of the House Public Safety Committee. privileged to bring before you House Bill 1186, which is at the request of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. The bill deals with those youth, and when I say youth, it's including those who are over the age of 18, even though they might have been convicted as juveniles, because the juvenile rehabilitation facilities now house quite a number of individuals over the age of 18. The research shows that it's much more beneficial to these youth if they are deemed not a threat to the community to be serving their sentence, so to speak, in the community rather than in an institution or in some other type of facility. It's a better access to treatment, to education and training, and for family reunification and many other benefits. So this bill proposes to create the Community Transition Services Program, which would allow for eligible youth in the custody of juvenile rehabilitation to be at home, in fact, and in the communities where their families live, so that they can have better access to and be more easily transitioning back into the community and on a better path after having perhaps gone wayward earlier. The department would have the review to determine whether these youth are safe to go home, and not only personal supervision, but electronic monitoring to monitor them, which in fact could be even a little bit more restrictive than just being in an institution. So I recommend this legislation to you. I believe that this is the right way to proceed, to give our youth a better chance at making a successful transition back into the community, rather than having them housed for long periods of time in facilities and institutions far away from home, which makes it more difficult for them to come back successfully into education and training and families. So I look forward to the testimony and look forward to working further on this legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Goodman. And with that, we'll move to public testimony. Vice Chair Harris-Talley, would you like to call forward the first, our three speakers, our first person?
Thank you, Chair Sun. We will begin testimony with our three speakers, with Allison Kretzinger, and queued up just after her will be Russell Brown.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Allison Kretzinger with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Thank you so much for hearing this legislation today. And thank you, Representative Goodman, for your sponsorship of the bill and many of the committee members who have signed on in support. DCYF, as we talked about last week, as I shared with you last week, has a strategic priority around creating successful transitions for young people exiting our systems of care, exiting our care and custody. We see this piece of legislation as an important next step in ensuring young people who are with us in the juvenile rehabilitation space have opportunities to transition into community-based settings, to build independence, practice the skills that are going to help them retain success later on, connect to education and employment opportunities in their community, as well as health, behavioral health, their family, and cultural opportunities. Right now, only 25% of the young people we serve have access to our community facilities. These are our community, DCYF community-run facilities across the state. So that means 75% of young people spend their entire time with us in an institutional setting. This does not help the transition back into community when they re-enter. And we see this as an important step in creating a continuum of step-down opportunities so young people really have the ability to garner the skills and supports they need. In addition, only 50% of young people release with aftercare or that wraparound support, meaning many go straight from an institutional setting back into their community without that wraparound support or that time to practice and build those skills necessary for success later on in life. This is the right time, and this is the right thing to do for young people. As a state, we have a responsibility to make sure young people leave our systems of care with the skills to succeed and better than they were when they entered our system. We have work to do. And we think this, we see the establishment of the community transition services option, least restrictive option, as an important next step to better serve youth and young adults in our care and custody. Luke did a great job with an overview, and thank you, Representative Goodman, for your comments. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions? Okay, seeing none, Madam Vice Chair.
Wonderful. Next in the queue is Russell Brown, to be followed by James McMahon.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Harris Talley, Ranking Member Representative Dent, and committee members. My name is Russell Brown. I'm the Executive Director for the Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. I'm here signed in as other on House Bill 1186. First, I want to thank Representative Goodman for bringing the bill and want to make it clear that my association is in strong support of the policy to create a transition. I guess I'd say the graduated reentry for juveniles. Also in full support of it, expanding the rental vouchers and all that this bill does to provide a wraparound service. We think this is absolutely an essential bill and absolutely the right thing to do and the right time to do it. I signed in as other. I think that my association has just, when we review it, there are just a couple of concerns about the allowing individuals who have been convicted juveniles of adult crimes into the same 60% eligibility as others. I think if they were removed, there would be less concern from our association. And I'm not saying completely removed, but if that 60% were changed or maybe raised to something a little higher. And the reason I say that is individuals who are convicted as juveniles of adult crimes, we're talking about serious violent offenses and or rape in the first degree and or repeated violent offenses. And so while we agree that these individuals need the transition just as much as other juveniles, this is the piece, I think, where we would like to maybe smooth out a little bit, maybe see a greater period of time served before they would be eligible for this particular provision. I think otherwise, the other parts of this, and even for those who are convicted of or adjudicated as in juvenile court, the 60% is something that we could live with, although we still think, you know, if that were expanded a little bit, that wouldn't be something that would offend us, and we could see some reasons for expanding that. Anyway, thank you for allowing us to testify, and we'd be happy to continue to work on this with a prime sponsor.
Thank you. Repairs Kelly, and call the next presenter.
Yes, Chair Sen, it looks as though a couple colleagues do have questions. Would you like to administer calling them up for questions to this particular
testimony? I think we'll have time, and I apologize for others who had questions earlier. We'll get to those too. Representative Wicks?
Thank you. I just had a question for our last testifier. Wanted to ask if we know that being in an institution is detrimental. I'm just curious why we would continue to leave someone that definitely does not need to be an institution and that will not help them succeed, can have a longer sentence and stay a longer period of time. I just wanted to know if you could speak to that.
Representative Wicks, thank you for the question. I think part of the calculus is both on what it does to the individual who committed the offense, but also to the individuals who are in the communities who were victims of those. For example, when we're talking about serious violent, we're talking about manslaughter, we're talking about assault in the first degree, kidnapping, assault of a child in the first degree, homicide by abuse. I mean, some pretty significant crimes with some victims who've suffered some significant harm. And so I think there's a balance, right? There is harm, certainly, to an individual in an incarceration, and yet we wouldn't release everybody because of that. And so I think in this balancing process, we appreciate that the initial calculus was set at 60%. We just think that for this group of individuals, a percentage of time more than 60% would be appropriate given the nature of the harm. I guess one other quick thought, an individual 17 years old who commits that crime would be eligible at 60% of their sentence for release through this graduated reentry-like program. An individual who's 18 who commits the same crime wouldn't be eligible until they had 6 months left of their sentence. And so I think it would make sense in our minds that those time periods are closer aligned, even if we are still talking about juveniles.
Thank you. Just one quick follow-up, if I may. Would you be comfortable with
Representative Wicks?
Would you be comfortable with lowering that for less smaller offenses as well, and making it graduated and not just starting with the 60? Just curious.
Let me make sure I understand. So you're saying that if for groups that are not the juveniles convicted of adult crime, but the convicted or adjudicated of a juvenile crime, I don't know that 60% that our association would say go lower than 60% on those. I think 60% is at least an appropriate floor, if not a little higher. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, Mr. McMahon.
Good afternoon, Madam. It is afternoon. Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm James McMahon, Policy Director with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. I think I signed in opposed to this bill today, though my testimony may reflect much of what you heard from my colleague, Mr. Brown, from the Prosecutors Association. Let me first say that we absolutely support successful reentry and rehabilitative efforts for all of those who find themselves in institutions, whether adult institutions like the Department of Corrections or institutions designed for youth like DCYF's facilities, because we think that their successful rehabilitation and reentry not only helps them, but it's also helpful for those in the community. However, as you heard from Mr. Brown, we need to ensure that we balance that with public safety protections as well. This legislation appears to be modeled at least somewhat after the graduated reentry program that was created within the Department of Corrections, I think in 2018, a crafting that we were directly involved in and were comfortable with that program when it came into play. Unfortunately, some of the provisions of this bill don't quite measure up to the protections that you all put into place with that graduated reentry program. We do appreciate the department has moved the text of this closer to that from earlier proposals that we saw earlier this summer. But we want to be part of that conversation to shore those up a little bit more. For example, the graduated reentry program says that a person has to spend at least 12 months in total confinement, similar to the 60%, though we agree with Mr. Brown, that number is perhaps a little bit deficient there. But the graduated reentry also says that they'll only spend the final 6 months of the term of confinement on the graduated reentry program, whereas we see the effectively the final 40% allowed here. We also don't see any language in this bill that takes in consideration the individual's participation or successful completion of any of the programming that happens while they are confined to a department institution. I would also ask the committee to perhaps maybe request Mr. Wickham to give you a list of the adjudications and the offenses by which an individual youth would have to be adjudicated of for their first or second offense in order to be subject to the department's jurisdiction. That list is quite a breathtaking list of frankly mostly violent and sex offenses. We don't send most of our youth to DCYF's facilities, and appropriately so. The measure of more than 30 days perhaps is a little bit deceptive as to what kind of offense types we're talking about. We do, however, want to remain to be part of the solution and not just those who point out problems. And to that end, I'm happy to say that we are scheduled to meet with DCYF, in fact, later this afternoon, to continue our discussion with them and see if we can get this bill to a proposal that we are comfortable with.
Thank you very much. Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question of DCYF. I guess Allison is still in the meeting here. I wanted to, the research is pretty clear that it is really not the offense that the individual is adjudicated of, but rather the risk level of that individual that matters in terms of any threats to community safety. So we could tend to be a little bit sensationalist about whatever offense there was, but in fact, it really is the dynamic factors in that person's life that matter. So I'm wondering from the department whether we can ease the concerns just expressed by describing the review process that the department would go through to make sure that this individual is not a threat to the community, and then again enhanced by the electronic monitoring at home in the community that would further the sort of intensive supervision, again, to protect those in the community from any potential risk.
Yeah, thank you. If I may respond, thanks, Representative Goodman and Representative Chair Sen, for the opportunity to respond. A little bit about the risk assessment. So one of the reasons we ask for delayed implementation in this bill is DCYF is undergoing a redesign of the risk assessment tool we use in juvenile rehabilitation. Early on in the tenure of DCYF, our research division, the Office of Innovation, Alignment, and Accountability, found that our tool that we used for risk assessment was pretty biased, pretty biased in implementation. And so we are undergoing a redesign of that. That should be completed by the end of this year, which is why we then feel we are will be confident in a updated and redesigned risk assessment tool to begin implementation the following year in 2022. And yeah, that's right. I mean, so we would look at things in our the language in the bill is pretty pretty vague right now, and happy to talk about that. But we can talk more about our risk assessment tool in addition to completion of the programming that young people have completed either in the institution or the community facilities. I think the young man who spoke to you last week did a really good job of describing sort of the therapeutic value that has sort of run its course as he remains in the community facility. And so those are all elements that would be included as we look at the review of young people, risk assessment tool, coupled with their engagement in programming, in therapy, in education, et cetera, while they're with us. And happy to provide more on that and obviously continue that conversation.
Thank you, Allison. Russ or James, would you like to comment on Representative Goodman's question?
I don't know that I, thank you, Chair Sen. I don't know that I know enough about the what type of evaluation or risk assessment that they will be performing to really answer that from Representative Goodman. It's a great question.
Fair enough.
I think that's appropriately responded to, but I don't know enough about it to respond.
And I would say, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. Certainly didn't mean to be sensational, but those are incredibly serious offenses that I think we need to take seriously. But I think Representative Goodman, his question is a great one, and DCYF's response is entirely appropriate. And those are the kinds of things that we would like to learn more about, to discuss, and frankly, ensure that are included in this bill. To make sure that it's not just because DCYF chooses to do those things, but we all know and are comfortable that those things are happening while we also address perhaps like the 60% threshold and some of the other considerations.
Thank you. And Allison, just as you mentioned, redoing your risk assessment, I know that there have been questions in the Department of Corrections, especially around risk assessment of foster youth and others. So hopefully you will be sharing your renewed findings and your new evaluation system, and maybe the Department of Corrections could take some of those changes as well. Representative McCaslin?
Finally. Thank you. So my question is for Allison. I guess in looking at Representative Goodman's bill, I'm wondering, Allison, will we as a committee have enough information to go off of without knowing what tool is going to be used that you guys are developing?
We feel confident you have enough information to make a decision. And with that said, happy to provide a more deeper analysis or briefing into some of the work that's happening right now in JR as we look at the risk assessment tool and the redesign of that. We can do that in writing. Happy to work with our Office of Innovation, or I know time is precious as we are in week two of virtual session, but also happy to come before the committee and provide a briefing on that if that would be helpful. If you feel like that would be helpful to inform the decision, we're absolutely available and more than willing.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes, thank you, Mr. McCallum. Okay.
So Allison, I guess I feel a little uncomfortable going ahead with this bill without having a clear picture of what your tool looks like. So if you could give us as much information as you can so we know what that's going to look like, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy to do that.
All right. And with that, Madam Vice Chair, are there anyone signing in not wishing to testify?
That closes out all who wish to testify. We do have 8 who signed up who did not wish to testify. I can speak them into record.
Please.
Yes. Paula Sardinas, Pro, with WBBA, FMSGS. Bob Cooper, Pro, with the National Association of Social Workers, Washington Chapter. Lori Lippold, Pro, with Partners for Our Children. Catherine Mahoney, Pro, with the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction. Neil Beaver, Pro, with Washington Defenders Association and the Washington Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. Melanie Smith, Pro, with NAMI Washington. Ann Lee, Pro, with Team Child. And Don Rains, Pro, with Treehouse.
Thank you, Vice Chair Harris-Talley. With that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 1186. And we will go back to the work session and take some of the questions. I recognize that most of the panelists are not with us. And I thank everybody for their patience. Wanted to get through a full committee, making sure we had plenty of time for testimony, and we zipped right on through. So apologize that we did not have more of a chance to take questions. So what I would love to do now is, for those who did have a question, to feel free to raise your hand again, and we will, so you can get your question on the record and share those, and we will make sure that we follow up with the presenters. Or if you would just like to follow up, not orally right now, we will be sure to forward those questions and make sure we get the replies to the committee as well. I know we had Representative Dent and Representative Ortiz Self and others. So again, apologize for not having a chance earlier. Representative Dent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question. My question was for Secretary Hunter and on one of the slides he had. So I'll just follow up with him and probably be easier and I'll get more information. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And if there's anything that you want to share with the committee at that point, we would welcome that too. Representative Harris-Talley.
Yes, I just wanted to add a question to the record, and I plan to follow up directly with, thank you, Chair Sims, with Department of Children and Youth and Family Services, but wanted to see the specific research about reduction of recidivism for youth that find themselves in community care instead of institutional care, because I know that there's a lot of positive research that shows that it actually lowers the incidence of crimes committed later. So we'll be following up for that data, and I'm happy to share it with colleagues upon a request.
Thank you so much. Any additional questions? And again, I know our great colleagues and presenters are always available to reach out, especially the DSCYF staff through Allison Kretzinger. Representative Chase.
Yeah, I was curious, the 60% figure, it sounds like the goal is to pass 60% of the juveniles who have been, incarcerated to the reentry program. And instead of 60%, why don't they could we just use like a recommendation from the prosecuting attorney and maybe the sheriff? Why is it like a certain ratio? Is that just a goal or?
And Representative Chase, you may wish to follow up with the department directly on that question or with your ranking, specifically to the House Bill 1186 versus to the work session. But appreciate that question and definitely feel free to explore that. Representative Callan, questions on the work session?
Yes, thank you. And on the, so just to follow up, I guess, so you're saying not questions to staff for clarification, just on the work session content?
On the work session content, because I think we closed the hearing on.
Yeah, that's fine. No worries. I'll follow up on with staff directly. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Any additional questions regarding the work session? Okay. Well, with that, we have finished all the business before the Children, Youth, and Families Committee. And you have
Madam Chair,
extra minutes. Yes, Representative Dent.
I'd just like to ask the Republicans to go into our caucus when after the chair adjourns the meeting.
Thank you. All right. And with that, we are adjourned.